Okay. Hi, everybody, and thanks for coming. I think everybody was here earlier in the week on Tuesday, so I don't need to introduce myself again. Rachel Aldrin from Westminster, anyway, and doing a cycling seminar series here, which feels slightly odd, as I said, on Tuesday. But today I'm going to be talking about cycling advocacy in London, which hopefully is quite an interesting story. I think it is, anyway, and it's one that's still going on, still developing. Okay, so it'll be interesting to hear any sort of thoughts about advocacy and other cycling advocacy in other contexts as well, because what we've got happening in London is quite unprecedented for the UK, I think. So I'm going to say something, just going to kind of introduce what I'm talking about, then talk about cycling policy and advocacy in the UK, a little bit of history, because you may not be familiar with some of the debates that have been going on for a very long time in the UK about cycling policy, and so I'll just say something about that. So thinking about London and cycling, because London is quite an interesting situation in relation to cycling, and the return of activism, give you some examples about what's been happening, stuff that's been going on really in the past couple of years mostly, and I've been watching debates sort of shift very dramatically under my eyes, which has been really quite exciting. And talk about this organisation, Londoners on Bikes, which I did a little case study of, and then just wrap up. So please feel free to ask questions or comments throughout, but I'm sure there'll be plenty of time for a discussion at the end as well. So I realised I was looking through this morning that I actually referenced myself too much, but there you go. I'll give till this the PDFs to circulate, but these are the kind of three articles that I'm talking based on, really. There's an article I wrote about transport in relation to state forms and how state forms, welfare state forms, have shifted, so that's that first one. I have a chapter in an edited collection looking at advocacy and activism that I wrote before the current, you know, I wrote it in sort of the end of 2010, really, and it was published in 2012, and I thought this is a bit out of date, but I did at least end the article by saying the future looks interesting, which turned out to be true. And an article specifically on this campaign group, Londoners on Bikes. So if you don't have access to any of them, then let me know. If you wanted to read them, I can just send them, particularly the middle one. You can't access online. And here, I guess, is a starting point as well for when I'm thinking about cycling and cycle advocacy. Do you know who that is? Anyone? Yeah, it's Boris Johnson. That's the Mayor of London. That is a particular image that he uses, that his team use of him, with his hair blowing in the wind and on his cycle hire bike and so on. But I guess what I'm saying in the advocacy and activism chapter, I guess, is that cycling is never just cycling. So it's always, and at the moment, particularly in London, it's argued over really hotly what cycling means, representations of cycling. And in the advocacy and activism chapter, I'm kind of drawing on social movement theory to talk about cycling, which is something that hasn't really been done that much before in the UK, partly because at the moment it seems like it is a social movement. Maybe before it didn't really seem that way, but I'm not going to talk that much about social movement theory, but that's just the kind of background to that article, sort of looking at how movements frame debates and how they argue about what cycling means and what cyclists look like, what cyclists should do, and so on. Okay, so a bit of prehistory in terms of policy and advocacy in the UK. This is the slide I showed before, but I realised actually it kind of really shows the annihilation of cycling. Cycling disappears, as I was saying on Tuesday in the UK, in the post-war period, it completely. Which a lot of people in the UK are quite surprised to see, actually, because I think we tend to think it declined slowly, but it didn't. It declined very rapidly, and then it kind of bumped along there.
Okay. Can I just shortly ask?
Yes.
The oil crisis had any effect on in the 70s, because it was slightly going up there. That's the oil crisis.
Yes. It does. It kind of goes up there and goes down again. And when I looked at the archives, I dug up some really interesting archive stuff around the history of cycling policy. And around about the mid-70s, there's a lot of stuff in the UK about, hey, cycling is on the rise. Everything's going to be different. So that gives you a bit of a sobering thought in the back of your head today. You know, in the mid-70s, there's a lot of really optimistic stuff published. Things are changing. Cycling is coming back. And also actually in the 80s too. In the 80s, what's happening there is a recession and cycling. There's a blip and then it goes down again. But it's worth, you know, when you look at the graphs at different points, if you're looking at the graph then, particularly if you're looking at the graph between there and there, it looks really positive, but then it disappears again. So there you go. So in the sort of article on transport and social policy, I'm talking about what happened to cycling in the UK and how it just disappeared like that. And I think one of the things that was going on was that it wasn't seen to fit into sort of the dominant ideologies of the post-war period. It didn't fit in either the narratives from the left parties in government or the right-wing parties in government. It just didn't fit with anyone's political story. And it seemed like, cycling seemed like it belonged to the past. There was a big shift towards larger organisational forms, a big shift towards a car, towards consumer capitalism, and the bicycle was not made to fit within that. It just didn't seem to fit. And I think what was really important was that it wasn't seen as a system or a service that could be debated. It just wasn't there at all. You know, it wasn't like you had cycle tracks, for example, that people could debate over. Should they exist? Should they be widened? Should they be narrowed? It just wasn't. It was invisible in policy terms. There was no debate about it. So, you know, we got rid of the railways, the branch lines, and there was a debate over that in the UK. But there was no debate around cycling. What will we do about cycling in the post-war period? It just didn't exist. And I kind of, in the article, I link it to these new concepts of citizenship, and citizenship being about the public sphere and the public provision of welfare and of services. And in the UK, cycling, you know, didn't fall into the public sphere. It fell into the private sphere. It was seen as something for leisure, for children. It wasn't, there was just no debate about it. It's incredible. Even though, if you look at that in the immediate post-war period, then actually 12% of all distance is by bike, which is not negligible, but it was not visible in policy terms. And this is you may have seen this. This is Traffic in Towns, the Buchanan Report from 1963, which actually I think is better than it's often painted. It's Buchanan is looking at the rise of the car and saying, how can the car fit into UK city centres, which are, you know, small, historic and so on. And he says, either you have to restrict the car, or you have to knock down city centres and rebuild something like this. And this is his plan for Tottenham Court Road in central London. It looks a bit like the Barbican, if anyone has ever been to the Barbican. And in case any of you have poor eyesight, I have circled cyclist. There is a cyclist. Took me a while to find him or her, but you can, I'm not sure if they're riding or walking, but you know, you can see it's really illustrative to me. You know, that's the car. There's plenty of space for buses. This is London, you know, public transport is important. There's plenty of space for pedestrians above, but there's no space for cyclists. And it just wasn't there. Buchanan, actually, he makes an aside in Traffic in Towns, which is quite telling. He says, you know, it'd be nice to have segregated cycle tracks, but they're simply far too expensive, which is kind of boggling when you think he's thinking about knocking down the centre of historic London and building that. But that was the debate. That seemed obvious. So sadly, this isn't London. This is Copenhagen. This is a protest around cycling in Copenhagen, but the reason I used this image was to... What is interesting as well is that the car was associated in the UK and many other countries as well with modernisation, with this new consumer capitalism, and it had this really strong narrative around it. This is the future. And when that narrative began to be questioned, the car began to be questioned as well. So in a sense, it was secure as long as consumer welfare capitalism was secure. But when we began to get challenges to that in the 1960s and 70s with the rise of the new left, the environmental movements and so on, then suddenly the car came into question and the bicycle returned. So yeah, these protests in Copenhagen, many similar events in other cities as well. And the car, from symbolising modernity, began to symbolise, you know, this path, this corrosive economic system that people were increasingly criticising. So, you know, it became, from being the dream future, it became kind of the nightmare present that we were trying to get away from. In the UK, unfortunately, though, by this point, we had like cycling at 1%. It really wasn't. So while in Copenhagen and places where you still had a lot of cycling, the bicycle could come back on the back of this. In the UK, it didn't really happen. We hoped, there was hopes that it might, but it didn't. So there was a blip, as Till mentioned, you know, the graph went up and then it went down again. So in the 70s in the UK, there were things going on similar to other countries in Western Europe when you got this reaction against the welfare, you know, the post-war settlement. And we had a number of well-known organisations formed in the 1970s, you know, Friends of the Earth, Cycle Bag, which was the ancestor of Sustrans, which is a big charity now. So a number of organisations like this formed in the 70s. And cycling did appear in the 1970s briefly on the political radar in the UK. And there was this study that still gets quoted now that looked at cities in the UK and said, actually, if cities that are flat and compact, which is quite a lot of them, could be made safe for cycling, 43% of trips to work could be made by bike. So, and at the time, about 3% of trips to work being made by bike. And there was a white paper from 1977. I really enjoyed looking up a lot of this stuff in the archives. A lot of this stuff isn't online, so I read these documents. So in 1977, there's a white paper from the government, then a Labour government, which offers money for innovatory cycling projects. And it says in the white paper, completely segregated cycle routes would be impractical or far too expensive in most cities. So the kind of cycle tracks you have here would be too expensive, not practical. But local authorities should consider ways of helping cyclists when preparing traffic management schemes, which kind of positions cyclists as this group that are a bit problematic and need some help. You know, it's a particular way of positioning cycling that I think we're still living with this. But yeah, so no big schemes, nothing that's too expensive, nothing that's too impractical, but if you can help cyclists, that is a good thing to do. So I just found this image. There's a lot of them floating around the internet right now. This is Margaret Thatcher opening the M25 in 1986, I think. Anyway, in the 1970s, as I was saying, cycling, although there was a bit of a political debate around cycling levels were so low, it really didn't get on the agenda in a serious way. It wasn't part of the mainstream transport system. It was sort of seen as a cheap local extra. You know, if you're a local authority that likes cycling, you can help cyclists. And in the 1980s, we got this again. The New Right, which very much saw the car as part of, Margaret Thatcher used to refer to the great car economy, in fact. The car was seen as part of making Britain great again. Cycling just totally disappeared again. But it's interesting to say something about cycling advocacy in this context, because cycling advocacy, I think, is shaped quite heavily by its context. And in the UK, we have a national organisation representing cyclists, as many countries do, which is called CTC now, but it used to stand for Cyclists Touring Club. They just call themselves CTC now. And it was very interesting. I went back and looked at some of their leaflets that they produced from the 1930s onwards, because they were obviously lobbying on behalf of cyclists. They were formed at the end of the 19th century, very much rooted in people who went cycle touring, hence the name. So they have a particular history linked to perhaps particular types of cycling. But they are the official, you know, national organisation that represents cyclists. So in the 1930s, the CTC was strongly opposing cycle tracks alongside roads, segregated cycle paths. Interestingly, at the time, they supported motorways on the grounds that if motorways were built, car traffic would go on motorways and cyclists could then keep the remaining roads. So in retrospect, seems slightly naive, but that was the position that they took. And in 1935, I found a pamphlet in which was called Perils of the Cycle Path, where they argued that cycle paths were unsafe and they shouldn't be built. By 1963, they were arguing the same position. So But what's kind of interesting is that there were obviously debates going on as well, because in 1963 they said, we have spent months considering this issue, but we have decided that our position remains the same. So there was obviously some kind of debate in the organisation. And they said, cycle tracks alongside roads were a danger and they gave a false sense of security. It said, potentially cycle tracks in new towns such as Stevenage could be supported, but in existing built-up areas, in either most of the UK, it said these would be obviously impractical, so they were still expressing quite strong opposition to cycle paths alongside roads. And it continues to generally, I would say, be quite sceptical of segregated cycle paths. So we have this particular history around cycle tracks, which continues to shape a lot of debates that are still going on in the UK. I guess this probably seems a bit weird. This is what happened. And to some extent, sometimes they do have a point, because this is, again, this is some of the kind of stuff that we have got in the UK under the description of cycle infrastructure, which I don't know what that's doing, and I don't know how notes you meant to cycle along that. But if you want to see some examples, that website, it'll be on the slides, gives some examples that give you a sense maybe of why people might be opposed to cycle tracks, if that's what cycle tracks look like. So the kind of continuing themes in cycling policy discourse in the UK, I guess, firstly is cycling is seen as something local. It's seen as something for local authorities, municipalities, to choose to do or not. And it's not seen as strategic. And I don't know if it's the same here, it may well be, but in the UK, if something's strategic, that means it will happen. You know, if it's strategic, you know, if it's a planning issue, then it may go to the national government, not the local government, and it will be seen as this is something that we have to do, even if people oppose it. Cycling has never really been strategic in that sense. It's always been something that fits in at a local level around other things that are more important. It's also seen as cheap, which is kind of double-edged. So cycling projects are seen as cheap. This means that they're not seen as prestigious. You know, ministers all want to open the new high-speed rail line. You know, cycling projects are seen as not glamorous in that respect. So they're seen as too cheap. But then when they're proposed, they're seen as too expensive, because cycling is seen as something cheap. So, you know, spending 20 million seems like, oh God, that's a lot of money. But obviously compared to some of the big prestigious rail and road things, they're not. It's not really. And cycling is seen as mainly an individual responsibility. So it's not traditionally seen as something that you complain to the state about. It's seen as something that individuals choose to do or not. So it's kind of this still really shapes a lot of what is going on in cycling in the UK, I think. Oh yeah, this slide, I really just wanted to show you as an example of what kind of thing gets held up in design manuals often in the UK as being, this is what we're aiming for. So this diagram appears in a lot of manuals. So it's saying that cycling on a narrow road, that's not great. That's not that great either. But this is okay. This is okay. If you've got, it says, if you've got at 30 miles an hour, cars and cyclists can pass each other comfortably at a 4.26 metres lane width. I'm not sure which cyclists are going to be overtaking a car going at 30 miles an hour, but apparently so. And at 30 miles an hour, with significant numbers of lorries overtaking can take place comfortably with a 5 metre width. So if you've got a 5 metre wide road and you're sharing the road with large numbers of lorries, that's actually okay at 30 miles an hour. So this always boggles me, but this is the kind of thing that the kind of design that sort of flows from this kind of approach to cycling. And from the 90s onwards, just to say something about cycling and how cycling advocacy changed before I get onto the London context. So I think things happened that have happened in other areas too, in terms of what happened to what's happened to a lot of voluntary organisations, campaigning organisations. A lot of these organisations got into service provision. So they started providing cycling-related services as well as campaigning, which you can imagine creates some kind of tensions in terms of they're providing services, but they're also campaigning to government for better services. So you get these kind of tensions. You get organisations providing services often on a shoestring, and then other people criticising those services. It gets kind of quite messy. So that happened. We got, from the 90s onwards, a lot of cycling organisations, local and national, began to collaborate with the state as well. They got quite involved in state programmes, local government programmes. And there were a load of initiatives, usually small and cheap, you know, and many, many very worthy things like setting up cycling clubs for refugees, those kind of things, small community projects. But it meant that advocates were spending a lot of their time doing those sorts of things, often for free. And a lot of promotion of cycling, this is healthy, this is good for the environment, this is cheap, this is fun, and so on. So very promotional aspect, but still without really changing the environment that people had to cycle in. It was more about telling them that this was a good thing to do. And the other thing was around cycle training. So in other words, it was an approach, this is quite an individualised approach. People, the idea that people need to learn skills to cycle, rather than making the environment better so they don't need those skills, we give them these additional skills so that they can cycle in those conditions without being scared or getting run over. But still, funnily enough, cycling levels didn't rise and targets kept being missed. They kept being missed and being abandoned. We were meant to quadruple cycling in, I think, 12 years. This didn't happen. It just carried on doing that. So it was there was this perceived failure, but a lot of the advocacy organisations were providing services. They were involved in local programmes. It was seen as maybe they were losing their campaigning edge. So with that as kind of a bit of background, I'm just going to talk about the London context and the rebirth of activism there. Okay, London, you probably know some of this already, but it's a city of 8 million, so it's growing as well. The population shrunk after World War II, now it's going up again. People are moving into London, the economy is growing, it's one of the few places in the UK where the economy is growing. And London's cycling levels, though, have always been low. Because public transport has always been good, because distances are quite long and some other reasons, cycling in London has never been that popular. And cycling in London is seen as particularly mad in the UK. People from outside London will say to me, "You cycle in London, you must be really brave." They will say that. But it's one of the few places that is seeing a rise in cycling. So we've had a doubling from a very low base, so like 1% to 2% of all trips. What's also important is that London is politically prominent. Unfortunately, the national media doesn't really care what happens in Hull. The national media really does care what happens in London. Most of them live there, for a start. And also, we have a London mayor who controls transport, and this is one of the main responsibilities of the London mayor. That and policing are the two big things. And we also have a pan-London transport authority, Transport for London, which kind of is responsible for overseeing transport in the whole of London. So you've got a political body that you can complain to, which is interesting. Although the municipalities, we have like 33 municipalities within London who also have some responsibility. And we spend a lot more on public transport than elsewhere. I think we spend more than twice what the rest of the UK spends per head on public transport. So it's established that we spend a lot on transport and we have a good public transport system. And the political profile of cycling in London has continued to grow. Yeah. So that cycling is seen as something that politicians increasingly want to be associated with. You know, whatever you think of the actual images and the documents, this has become visible, which is interesting. It is 2008. Yeah, 2008, way to go, planning for better transport. That is a transport plan, it's not a cycling plan, but it has somebody on a bicycle on the front of it there. What we've also seen is in London is the concentration of cycling. So although cycling's modal share is 2%, commuting in some boroughs is as high as 15% commuting to work cycling. So these are just some inner London boroughs. And those are the percentages going to work by bicycle. So that's Hackney, 15% cycle to work, 13% drive to work. So these figures are quite interesting. Islington, they're about the same, 10% each. Some of the other inner London boroughs, you can see car, you know, driving is higher. But cycling is still 8% or so, 7 or 8%. So it's starting to matter politically. If you start to get, you know, 10% of people cycling to work, it matters, particularly in inner London, which is actually the more visible, the more privileged bit of London these days. So we've seen this really interesting demographic and sort of political situation developing. And yeah, this is another, this shows you cycling is really concentrated. So this is people coming into central London in the morning during the rush hour by mode of transport. And you can see most people are coming in by public transport. It's a public transport dominated city. But this is interesting, right? This is car and cycle. So in 2000, 137,000 people coming in by car, 12,000 by bike. As a politician, you will see that. You will see, like, who are these people who are cycling? They're quite marginal. Now, 67,000 by car, 33,000 by bike. That's quite a big change. It means that, you know, yeah, politicians, officials who see that, you know, think, wow, actually, you know, of the people combining car and cycle travellers coming into London in the morning, a third a bike, two-thirds a car. So it makes a difference. It's much more visible. And we've also seen an increase in cycling expenditure. So from 3 million a year back in 2003-04, it's now around 73 million a year. So there's been quite a substantial increase in funding, although quite a lot of it has gone to the Barclays Cycle Hire Scheme. But there's still an increase, and it's going to, the next few years, it's going to be like around about that level, about £10 a head. So, you know, not what Copenhagen spends, but compared to the rest of the UK, which probably spends about £1 per person, it's, you know, it's starting to look serious. But, this is a really big but, that still, it hasn't translated into a transformation in cycling conditions. And designs, Transport for London, in their London Cycle Design Standards, talk about different categories of cyclist, and they actually have a category called the hardened commuter. This is the hardened commuter. You imagine that they've grown a kind of exoskeleton so that they're protected or something like that. And there's still this assumption that you're building for the hardened commuter. You're not building for the 12-year-old. You're not building for the 8-year-old. You're building for the hardened commuter. And this is Cycle Superhighway 2 in East London. And I'm rather hoping that Copenhagen's Cycle Superhighway 2 that I get to see tomorrow will be better than this. This is a junction crossing. This is basically mixing with motor traffic. And this person looks like they are mixing with a lot of motor traffic. So we're still that kind of thing, unfortunately, despite the increased political prominence of cycling. However, it has had the result that a number of people have heard, yeah, there's a superhighway, let's go and try that out, and they've ended up on that, and they're not happy. Understandably so. That guy's probably not very happy. People smile here while they're cycling, I've noticed. This is good. This is a design by a Dutch artist called Bianca Ansems, who's moved to London, and she is called the Neon Warrior. In England, cycling is not leisure, it is war. And she's drawing this image based on what she's seen in London. And yeah, this is the Brompton, the briefcase. I like the fact he's got a little angle lamp on his head. But this is the kind of thing partway between Darth Vader and a Christmas tree that I kind of described in a little article. But just to illustrate this as well, I gave you a couple of quotes from the Cycling Cultures Project, a couple of people from Hackney, who people talk about this pressure to do this. So I could do more to make myself visible. This idea that you have to make yourself visible as a cyclist, otherwise you'll be invisible. And lots of talk about what is the most visible colour. Orange is the most visible colour, and I've got snap bands around my wrists and around the bike, and this sense that you'll be invisible. And I think it's kind of linked to the invisibility of cycling in policy discourse. It's like, you know, where are cyclists? We can't see them, we can't place them. And We also have, this is for London, these are figures for London. And the second one is pedal cyclists. And this is casualties, fatal and serious casualties, and changes that have happened between 2005 to 2009 and the 12 months ending December 2011. And you can see the main thing to note here is that there's been decreases in all casualty groups apart from cyclists, which has gone up 36%. And that's a significant, significant result. So cycle casualties have been going up. And also a lot of talk from the people I interviewed from London for Cycling Cultures that this fear, this, you know, I don't want my son to go on the roads. He's got to really understand that cars can kill you. Every time I get on a bike, I come within this far of getting mashed. So it's quite a hostile environment, really. You know, they become very politically visible. I just wanted to show you this on that note, because this is bicycle deaths and serious injuries, and that's pedestrian deaths and serious injuries. So over this period, cycling has around doubled. So you can see that the rate, the rate has improved if you looked at it as a rate per kilometre, but the number of pedestrian deaths and serious injuries has halved, and probably walking has stayed about the same. So then cycling is not becoming relatively more safe, because walking has become more safe as well, about the same ratio. That's if walking has stayed about the same, which it probably has, then walking has become twice as safe. But cycling, the same thing has happened in cycling, but we haven't had an additional safety in numbers effect. So that kind of makes sense. It's not, relative to other modes, it's not becoming any more safe.
Safety concern of the policies, the cycling policies, is it a major focus area?
Yeah. Yes. And what's kind of quite interesting that I'll come onto in a little bit is that it's becoming more, traditionally it's become, this is a problem for cyclists. It's been that this is a problem for cyclists. Now it's becoming more, this is something that policymakers need to do something about. So I think the discourse has changed. Okay, so we've got the kind of context where cycling is increasingly politically prominent in London. It's been increasing in certain very specific areas, certain times of day, but at the same time, the injury figures are not great. We've still got it sticking around that level, whereas for other modes, it's decreasing. So, the rebirth of activism. So we have a context, I think, where, you know, it's things are getting looking kind of like something might happen, and it did happen. I'll mention this again later, but this is really unprecedented. The Times. This is a mainstream newspaper, a right-wing newspaper, a Murdoch newspaper, that is running repeatedly front pages saying that cyclists should have a better deal. This is really something, it's not something that we've experienced before. It's not The Guardian, which is a left-wing newspaper. This is something really quite different. And these are a couple of just examples of protest rides, protests that have happened in London as well. So the really, things have got quite interesting. So I just want to tell you a little bit about how that happened. Has anybody heard of Waltham Forest? That's probably the same response you would get in the UK outside of London. It's a really obscure London borough. It's up there. It's not fashionable like Hackney. It's not wealthy like Kensington and Chelsea. It's not, the only way you might hear of it is if there'd been a stabbing or something. It's one of those places that is not well known. It's an obscure London borough. But what happened, this is really quite an interesting story, I think. It's not, things happen where you don't expect them to. So, this, you probably can't see this that well, but I wanted to show you the whole of the blog post. This is a blog called Crap Cycling and Walking in Waltham Forest. How parochial can you get? This is an obscure London borough, and this is talking about cycling and walking being not very good in this borough. And he or she started in 2007 in with a post called The Bromley Road Cycle Stand. Who's interested in the Bromley Road Cycle Stand in Waltham Forest? Probably not many people, right? It's a bit boring. Just one of hundreds of examples of the London Borough of Waltham Forest's failure to look after the interests of cyclists and pedestrians. He's complaining about the fact that this local shop has padlocked a sign to the cycle stand, so you can't padlock your bicycle and cycle stand. It's not interesting, is it? Not very interesting. However, the last sentence is interesting. He says it's time more London cyclists posted blogs showing just how crap London is for cycling. So this is a kind of, we want to tell the real story, even if it's not very interesting. And this is where it all started, really. There's also quite an important, he carried on blogging regularly, often every week, often really long detailed posts about how bad cycling was in Waltham Forest. Continually posting this, became quite notorious, and a lot of people would read his blog. This was the warts and all, even if it was about a cycle stand in a road you didn't know about. This was the other story. This wasn't cycling is great, cycling is healthy. This is like cycling is rubbish, why? And so this is Waltham Forest, cycling in Waltham Forest on a recommended cycle route. You can see why people were getting a bit upset about this when they were constantly being told cycling was great, cycling is the thing to do. This is a post of his from 2010 where he says, I've seen the light, the future is the Netherlands. And he showed a picture of a cycle path in Assen. And this actually starts the debate shifting in the UK, where people actually start to say, you know, they can see videos, they can see photos, that all these things are available. And they say, well, why isn't it like this rather than like that? And it seems obvious in retrospect, but this is kind of bubbling along for a really long time. This is great. Many of these blogs, well, he's famously sarcastic, this guy, Freewheeler, who wrote this blog. And I just wanted to give you an example of some of the arguments, some of the sort of sarcasm and the humour. So he wrote something called Field Guide to British Cycling Activists last year. So he's talking about the CTC, the organisation I was just talking about earlier. And he says, the CTC activist is easily recognised by his tense expression and powerful stare. Fond of dropped handlebars and brightly coloured jerseys, the CTC activist is very, very particular about how handlebar tape should be applied. He favours tight clothing, which displays his scrotum to best advantage. Sometimes he exhibits a fondness for leather straps. He never eats Dutch cheese on the grounds that if he does, he might then be banned from eating cheddar. He feels strongly that cyclists belong on the roads. He's sometimes woken in the night by nightmares of being prevented from cycling down his local high street by armed Dutch police. Now, you can imagine how that went down in the CTC, can't you? So there's these kind of quite often acrimonious debates between these new activists and the people who feel that they've been campaigning in this area for decades. How dare these people mock them in this way? And I would recommend the Crap Waltham Forest. He doesn't blog anymore, but it's all archived up there. It's quite entertaining. So there's all this stuff going on. And in fact, there's a profusion of blogs after a bit. So these are just, I think I listed quite easily 10 blogs that are about cycling politics in London that post regularly. There's varying levels of, there's a lot of different styles. If you want one that swears a lot, or if you want one that's friendly and fluffy, you can find one. You know, there's different, some blogs have a lot of interactive discussion on them, some don't. So there's a whole range of stuff out there, but it, broadly speaking, has the same kind of approach. Cycle campaigning has failed miserably. It needs to become much more confrontational, much more saying, you know, we want this kind of infrastructure, we want segregated infrastructure, we don't want to cycle on the roads. And this is from the Alternative Department for Transport, who does a blog, and he's saying there, nobody, this is an advanced stop lane, which I think has been the thing that transport planners in London have put in when they want to do something for cyclists. Let's put in an advanced stop box. So he's saying no one is waiting for these to be enforced because, you know, motorists don't respect them. There's always cars in them. It's rubbish. But he says no one's waiting for these to be enforced Nobody is saying, if only there were more areas at traffic lights where I could sit in front of growling motor vehicles, I'd take up riding tomorrow. So again, the kind of sarcasm. And he says, a rare instance of an advanced stop zone relatively free of motor vehicles. Does this attract people to cycling? Oh, lovely, a painted area that allows us to position ourselves in front of heavy vehicles. Let's do this every day. So very much not saying, oh, thank you for putting in an advanced stop box, but, you know, what are you doing this for? This is rubbish. And believe me, you can spend an awful lot of your time sitting reading these blogs if you're not careful, particularly if you can convince yourself it's work. It's also on Twitter as well, so the various... This was just a screenshot from yesterday. So, you know, weak plans for cyclists and major junction. People are discussing all this stuff on Twitter and, yeah, sharing a lot of material in a range of ways. So the blogs... And I don't think this has happened in other places, because I have a PhD student, Laura, who's looking at cycling activism in London, Paris and New York, and she finds that it's not the same in Paris and New York. In Paris, there's hardly any blogs. In New York, it's kind of quite different. There's the streets blog. There's not individuals doing this in this way. But what's been important for us has been that it's like social media, that people are sharing text. They can cut bits out of design manuals. They can take pictures in the Netherlands or in their local high street. They can take videos, and they can share all these things instantly. So it's not like, you know, describing to people at great length. It's like you can show them a picture, and people can then say, no, I don't like that. They can have, you know, it's created this level of debate. And a lot of these bloggers feel like they're speaking for people who don't cycle. They criticise cycle campaigning as having been, you know, around the 2% who already cycle. So they see themselves as speaking for the people who don't cycle, which is kind of an interesting tension, because obviously they cycle, so they're trying to speak for others who don't. Anonymity is really important. The fact that people can put these things up and you don't know who they are. So Crap Waltham Forest, freewheeler, there's a kind of almost James Bond, Scarlet Pimpernel kind of thing around him, because nobody knows who he is the big thing. But, you know, obviously some people do. But it's like my PhD student Laura was like, oh, I kept meeting people who said they knew someone who knew him, but I never got to speak to him.
You know that he's a guy.
Yeah, people say that. And then they said, like, I didn't say he or she, but it is. I tell you, the bike world is quite male. The blogging world is quite male. If you put them together, then nearly all the bike bloggers are male. Which is another issue. They also allow the democratisation of expertise, I think. So they'll take an engineering drawing and they'll provide pictures, often in great detail. This is what it will look like. This is what this kind of, you know, this is what a Dutch junction looks like in an engineering drawing. This is what it looks like when you cycle through it. It's really high level often, really high level of debate. And they also present the facts differently. So... for example, if you say cyclists are 2% of mode share in London, that sounds a bit crap. But if you say cyclists are 50% of the vehicles going over the bridges in the morning, that sounds pretty good. So they present the facts in different ways. And they also are seen as people, because cycling is being taken up among often, you know, middle or higher income men cycling into central London, this is seen as a politically influential group. So there's kind of some interesting stuff going on there too. They've reframed debates, like around safety. So, you know, they say safety is something Transport for London must take responsibility for. You know, it's not a case of us wearing helmets, it's a case of them doing something. And there's been a sense of a growing movement that things, you know, things are coming together, and people network on and offline. There are a lot of meetings that people have as well. There are events that people go to. And it's funny when you meet people, because I was recently at an event where there are various people, bike bloggers and so on, and one of them said to me, oh, have you met Joe over here? And I was kind of like, no, I don't think so. And this guy I was speaking to said, oh, he's Schrodinger's cat, which is the name of his blog name. We're like, oh, yeah, Schrodinger's cat, yeah. And it's also contributed to a shift in established organisations. So in London, we've got the London Cycling Campaign, which is a more established cycle campaign organisation. And the rise of these blogs, although it's caused some friction, has actually pushed, to some extent, the existing organisations to be more pro-segregation and also more willing to organise, you know, protests and so on. So I think you have something similar in environmental organisations often. You've got the kind of direct action people who go out there, and you've got the established organisation that goes, we don't really approve of that, but on the other hand, these people are getting a lot of press. So these are just some examples. This is quite funny. When you do a, when I did a YouTube search for CS2 Superhighway, that's one of our, the superhighway I showed you earlier, you don't get some promotional video come up.
No.
You get videos that people have shot showing you about how bad these pieces of infrastructure are, which is quite funny. But people share all this stuff on YouTube and so on. This is just a picture from one of... a flash ride that was co-organised by the London Cycling Campaign. There were plans to make this bridge a lot worse for cycling, which sadly did happen. But there was there were protest events, various things organised, shared on Twitter and on the blogs. And yeah, the ride went to Old Street, a place which is quite symbolic there.
In the pictures, there are hardly any children.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting, people were encouraged to bring their children on some of these rides, but mostly they didn't, because they were too scared, I think, of taking their children to the start of the, you know, on the protest they'd be fine, but to get them there, they were nervous. Yeah. And in fact, some of these rides attracted a lot of people wearing helmets and fluorescent jackets, which then there were debates about in the cycling movement about whether that was a good thing or not. That's just another cover of the Times, which has repeatedly carried on covering cycling on the front page. Okay, so I just wanted to wind up by saying something about a specific organisation that I did a bit of research on, called Londoners on Bikes. So we had a mayoral election last year, and Londoners on Bikes, okay, I think I've said that, so I don't need to say that. Anyway, Londoners on Bikes was an organisation that was set up to influence the mayoral election. And the politics of this were quite interesting, because they were specifically trying to mobilise the bike vote. They were trying to get people to vote as cyclists, which was kind of quite unprecedented, really. I mean, obviously, the established cycling organisations would say to people, think about cycling when you vote. But this was an organisation specifically set up, we are Londoners on Bikes, we are voting with our bikes. And I did a small piece of research last year where we attended this group's events. We conducted some in-depth interviews. There were quite a large representation of women in this group, which was interesting, and quite a few younger people too. So that was quite an interesting mix of activists. And we also did a couple of online surveys, but I'm mostly just going to talk a bit about the interviews. So this was called a pop-up campaign. Everything is pop-up in London at the moment. It was a pop-up campaign that set up to mobilise the bike vote. One of the important things about it being a pop-up campaign was that people could get involved for a short period of time. They didn't have to say, I'm a bike activist. They could just do it for a bit. And they hoped to sign up 10,000 people, to say they would vote with their bikes. And in the end, they got 6,633. And they still thought this was quite positive. They thought the 10,000 was quite ambitious, so they were quite happy with that. And they organised on and offline. They would use social media to arrange meetups. There's kind of a sense, when I was involved in it, a sense that there was almost a kind of undercover network, because people would have on the website, we're going to do leafleting. Which leafleting can you make? So you'd sign up and you'd turn up and there'd be somebody you'd never met before there with the leaflets. And it was I think that worked quite well. Obviously, it wouldn't work quite well if you turned up and there was nobody else there, but I know that never happened to me. And they also did crowdsourced funding. They would put out calls for funding, and they actually got more money than they knew what to do with at times. So it was seen as a way that they could make a difference for cycling at an appropriate scale. So it was like you could act at a London-wide level, which was really important, because this person was talking about how they got involved through local environmental campaigning. But the two things that came up around cycling were security of bikes, not getting your bike stolen, which is a big issue everywhere, and safety on the roads. So this person who was involved in Londoners on Bikes could do something locally about the bike parking. It's not that hard to get bike parking installed, at least Sheffield stands, the basic metal stands. But he couldn't do anything about bike safety in his street, because, you know, it's about travelling through the city. So he thought Londoners on Bikes allowed him to speak, you know, at a city-wide level, to make a noise at a mayoral level about safety on the streets, and it was sort of an appropriate level to do that. And people who were involved in Londoners on Bikes, the kind of the link with blogging as well, is that many of them had got involved in cycle activism through reading the blogs, through finding out about what was going on, and through attending the protest rides. And they had a really strong sense of being a young movement, as they described it, which was interesting because obviously we do have a history of cycle campaigning. You know, this has, you know, since the beginning of cycling. But this was seen by the people involved as a young and an exciting movement. So this was somebody, she'd gone on the Blackfriars Bridge ride, and she thought, hey, there's loads of people, and they're all like normal cyclists. So it's like it was people who were normal that she could be involved in, not this kind of idea of a cyclist at war. But she said she was really struck because many of these people had been involved in activism of other sorts. These were the core people involved in the Londoners on Bikes group. And they had maybe been involved in environmental or feminist campaigning, different areas. So she'd been on protest before, but she said, we were really struck. We didn't have any songs to sing. No one had created any bike songs, you know. You couldn't, sing. Well, we've got loads, yeah. I won't sing them, but there's various political songs that you can sing in other contexts. But there were no bike songs. And she said, it really struck me how young we were in terms of politics. We didn't have anything to shout. So this kind of protest ride would go round. They wouldn't shout. They would sometimes have placards, but not even that. Sometimes it was just a big mass of cyclists, which sometimes people would worry, well, has anyone know what we're doing? You know, people might just think we're just going for a ride and there's 1,000 of us. And they really had a thing, this links to what I was saying on Tuesday, really a thing about the word cyclist. The word cyclist is really problematic in the UK, the associations that it has. And people felt very strongly that they called the organisation Londoners on Bikes because they didn't want to be seen as cyclists. That's Alan Bennett, who's one of our national treasures, a writer anyway, so on a bike. So this is the image. They wanted an image of somebody who wasn't a cyclist. So a few people talked about this. And the first guy says, there's something dehumanising about the term cyclist. It sort of removes the fact you're dealing with people. So it's like, this is a cyclist. And he says, you know, a person dies on a bicycle and all you hear is a cyclist has been killed. So it's like, it's a way of taking away humanity from people even, to describe them as a cyclist, because the term is so loaded in the UK. It's like a stigma almost. Somebody else, it's about the fact that cyclists are people, soft, squidgy people on bikes. You know, this is somebody else saying, yeah, we like the image of the Alan Bennett cyclist, you know, the normal cyclist, not the helmet and Lycra cyclist. And somebody else, he said, I think it was a particular bike blogger, because the bike bloggers were also involved early on in this, who said to us, you have to be careful of the word cycle, because cyclists are in Lycra, and they do jump red lights. So don't use the word cyclist. So,
is there a similar connection to the word car driver or motorist? Is there something similar to that? Because, I mean, if you die in a car accident, you know, do they say a car driver died, or do they say this many people died in a car crash?
I think they're less likely to say car driver or motorist died. Yeah, it becomes more because motoring is so naturalised. There's some really interesting stuff around the language. So if somebody dies, it will often be just a person died in a car. But then if someone drives into a bollard or drives into a wall, it's often a car went into a wall. So there's some really interesting stuff around the language, but it's definitely really different for cycling. For cycling, it's often a cyclist did this.
Is the difference between cyclist and the person on a bike, is it the same in the whole UK, or is it specifically for London? That this Lycra people is a cyclist, is that for the whole country?
In fact, one of the bloggers, a blogger who only blogged a little bit and then stopped, used to call himself, I am not a cyclist. But the rest of the UK is the same thing. And people were also struggling with their own, how they were themselves as a cyclist. So when I spoke to people about how they saw themselves, when my colleagues spoke to people about how they saw themselves, they would say, you know, I don't see myself as a cyclist. So almost Londoners on bikes gave them an identity as not being a cyclist. I don't wear a helmet. I don't like the idea of wearing fluorescent jackets, so car drivers have an excuse not to hit me. And not being bikey, not being, you know, I've never cycled anywhere with a group or anything. I've never been on a cycling holiday, God forbid. I've just always cycled for my whole life. And somebody else, she's talking about, she says, I'm probably mid-green as far as politics are concerned. But she says, it's not something I associate with cycling. So it's like creating a space for cycling politics that is distinct. She says, I cycle because I hate the tube, the underground. I guess my cycling identity is quite functional. It's the way I go round. And then she says, although I do love it. And then she laughs, because it's almost embarrassing that she loves cycling. It's like, it's got to be something that she just does. And it was also, the idea of Londoners on bikes was really tied to the city, about transforming the city. So this kind of strong London identity. This map, actually, this shows, this is where they did a tour de bike shops. So they got supporters to go around bike shops and give leaflets out about the campaign. And this shows where people went around bike shops. And London, the M25 encloses London. So you can see it's actually inner London. It's really the inner boroughs where they're concentrated. So they're not the whole of London, but there is this image of the whole of London, which is interesting. And one of the people that I interviewed, she said, I identify myself as a Londoner. I'm much more comfortable saying I'm a Londoner than saying I'm British or English. I feel like a Londoner. And that's a very cosmopolitan inner London identity. So it's interesting that way. But what I also came across, what we also found, was that people involved in the campaign, some of them didn't even live in London at all. Some of them, because a lot of people commute into London, usually by rail, and increasingly you're getting, with the demographic that's taking up cycling in London, they cycle in with a folded bike, a Brompton, quite an expensive bike, and then they cycle to work once they get off the train, rather than use the tube. So some of those people are involved, but they don't get a vote in the election. So where do they sit? That was quite interesting. I did some leafleting with a guy who was in that position, and he said, yeah, a lot of people who are cycling in London don't live in London, so I can't vote. And a lot of people we spoke to said, I'm going to the station, I don't have a vote, but it's important. So he was arguing that Londoners on bikes should be about people who cycle in London, not people who live in London. But then the election was not about people who, you know, people who lived in London, it's only people who live in London who got a vote. So there's a kind of tension about whose city it was and, you know, who had a voice in the campaign. But at the same time as well, it was like really tied to people's localities. So even though there's an imaginary, the whole of London, it was still people's localities that often mattered to them, where they lived or worked. So one of the people that we interviewed, she said, it was the King's Cross thing. She works in King's Cross, this woman. And a young woman was killed, a student, a design student, I think, at King's Cross. There's a really bad road location. So this woman heard about the death on a bicycle, and she works in the area with young people. So she obviously made a connection to the young people that she works with, to this young woman dying in King's Cross on a bicycle. And she thought, this is their space. This is the space we move around in. And she said she hadn't really thought about it before, but it was the fact that it was local to her, it was focused on King's Cross. So people could make the connection, you know, either places they cycled through, places they lived, places they worked. And this is just an example of, that's one protest outside Addison Lee. It's a taxi firm that's kind of a bit notorious in London. And the head of the firm published an article where he said sort of cyclists deserve to get run over, they shouldn't be on the roads. And he got a lot of flack for it. So that's a protest outside Addison Lee. And there are also a series of protests at King's Cross. What is interesting is that there are a number of different groups that started, and some of them didn't survive, but they were still part of it. So there's this group, Bikes Alive, that kind of fizzled away, but they had some rides around King's Cross. They had they were cycling very slowly, walking very slowly around King's Cross, was quite interesting. It seemed like the police didn't quite know what to do with those kind of things. That, you know, they didn't. They'd obviously been told. Think about it. The mayor controls the police. I think they'd been told not to hold off, not to go in and arrest people. But really, you're not meant to go round and round at 3 miles an hour in King's Cross and right in central London at 6 p.m. So people, there's all this kind of stuff going on. And it was one of the things that the activists were doing that was really important was that they were making cycling seem like a political issue that you can struggle over. So maybe that seems obvious in a higher cycling context, but for us it wasn't obvious. It was like it wasn't necessarily seen as something you have political struggle over. And people would say that, you know, they didn't used to see cycling as political. People would say, you know, our job is to make people see it's political, you know. And but the people, the activists, had only come to that view quite recently. And one of the person there, she says, I was not really a bicycle advocate before. She said she hadn't changed her views, but now she had a political vocabulary for them. So instead of cycling along and being cross, she would, you know, there was something she could do, there's some way she could express it that she wouldn't have had before. And it was quite, you know, there was a mayoral hustings that was focused just around cycling, which was pretty unprecedented. It was in Westminster Central Hall, or the Mechanics Institute, anyway, somewhere really central, a really full room, talking about cycling, the mayoral candidates, all of them. And they also, another thing that was I found really interesting was that they drew on other narratives. I said they'd been involved in other advocacy organisations before. So some of them had been involved in peace activism. And this woman who said, you know, she came to realise that peace was not something for the United Nations. Peace was something, peace in London was about being safe on the streets, was about not having to feel like you're going into a war zone. She said, this is another space in which there is an absence of peace. And she actually then goes on to talk about the UN Convention ought to be applied to London streets because people are not able to move around the city. So some really quite interesting discourses. And the state, you know, the state has a duty of care to protect citizens. So this kind of, you know, it's not us that should be worrying about it, the state should protect us. And another one, so I mentioned safety in numbers earlier, which is this argument that, you know, you get more cyclists, it becomes safer, which is very strong in UK cycling policy narratives, even though it doesn't seem to be happening in London at the moment, not compared with other modes. Other modes are getting safe. And so I raised this with one of the activists I interviewed, and I said, you know, what do you think of safety in numbers? And she got really fired up, so I put some of it in italics to indicate that. She says it's like sending lots of people over the top in the Somme, she says, because some of them will get there, the rest of them will be mown down, you know, but you can't say let's just keep throwing lots of nice soft bodies into the paths of the cars until the cars get used to avoiding them, because people are going to get hurt and that's just irresponsible. The impact on an individual and everyone around them, if something happens to them, is so massive. You can't be like, it's collateral damage. So she's kind of using sort of peace movement-y type terms here. She says, I'm a pretty competent cyclist, so having some cannon fodder out there might be good for me personally, but I just don't accept that. So she did, you know, I was kind of like, wow. She started talking about that. I thought she wouldn't like it, but I didn't know she was so passionate about it. And she's talking about World War One and collateral damage, and really passionate. So, yeah. I think there's lots of other stuff I could talk about. I think that's a good point to conclude, and just to say something about London cycle advocacy as a social movement. So it's kind of interesting what the social base is. So we've had, I think in London we've got a lot of suppressed demand for cycling, if you want to put it that way. Basically, the people who are taking up cycling are taking up cycling in quite big numbers, but these are the people for whom cycling is relatively easy. These are often young professionals who don't have dependents, who cycle into central London, who have perhaps relatively good cycle routes in context, who are doing commutes. And the interesting thing about commutes, of course, is you have a route, you can keep doing it. You know, you don't have to find a new route every day. It's not like going to different places. So there's, you know, those people who have that relatively easy, who are the kind of people who can cope with cycling in London, are taking it up. And that has created quite a lot of pressure But those people, the people who are advocates, are kind of really aware of the limitations of that and want, you know, what can we do to broaden it beyond ourselves? And some of the people who blog are really concerned about equality and you know, thinking about how they can do it. But the interesting thing is as well that their social base, the fact that they're seen as a relatively privileged group, has acted in their favour in some respects. So it's kind of, it's quite an interesting situation. And they're speaking, so they're trying to speak for potential cyclists. They're making this claim on behalf of the people who cannot cycle. There's also stuff, there's stuff around class and people who've taken it up. And one group who've taken it up is journalists. Journalists are taking up cycling, hence, you know, some of the media campaigns are influenced by the fact that a lot of these journalists are cycling to work. And it's almost becoming, it's funny, the other day I listened to this radio programme in the morning. It's classical music in the morning, and it's the presenter just mentioned as an aside, "Oh, since I've been cycling in London," and it's kind of like, you know, this classical music presenter, I had no idea he cycled in London. It almost feels like people are coming out all over the place. It's like, but these are people who have a voice. These are people who make programmes, who write newspapers often, and they're people who, some of these people are used to being treated quite well at work. You know, they are maybe, some of them are tax lawyers, for example, and they're really not used to being treated like second-class citizens. And when they get on their bicycles, they're quite angry that suddenly somebody might kill them, whereas normally people would defer to them. So there's some quite interesting dynamics. Gender is such a big issue. So I mentioned the bike bloggers. They are all male, almost. It is... And yet they're often writing, critiquing the existing campaigns for being male-dominated. So it's kind of, it's interesting how that works. Interestingly, actually, the London Cycling Campaign, in their board elections at the end of last year, got a 50% female board, which was the first time ever. Cycle campaign, the CTC, for example, has 18 councillors and 16 or 17 are male. This has always been like that. But in the London Cycling Campaign, it's much more mixed now. And Londoners on Bikes had quite a mix of men and women. London, I think partly to do with Londoners on Bikes used a lot of newer social media like Facebook and Twitter, and it seemed like somehow there were more women who got involved in that than who get involved in blogging, which is more, you know, you write basically like a lecture or something, and then if you're nice, you let people comment on it. It's interesting how that works. So lots of social media, blogs, Twitter, Facebook. And people talk about emails as personal communication, which is interesting that email is seen as sort of a traditional personal way to contact people, and Facebook is like newer and having a conversation with lots of people. The claims in the article I wrote about Londoners on Bikes, I kind of talk about how the claims they make, they're both about recognition. They're about, we deserve to be recognised as people on bikes. This is an acceptable identity. We are not cyclists who wear lycra and go through red. We are people on bikes. We are people and Londoners. But also, of course, distribution-based claims. So they're making claims about road space. They're making claims about priority on the roads. So they're making those two types of claims at the same time. So in some ways, the sort of the social movement theory stuff is about, you know, old movements are about money, new movements are about identity. And they're kind of doing both of those, I think. And even though there are so many problems still, even though there's so many limitations, I would say they've really had very impressive successes in what is a difficult context. I think it's incredible what they've done, really. This gives you a flavour. This is the mayor's cycling plan in 2010 in London. So this is Cycling Revolution London, and that is the image on the inside cover. So, yeah. It's a man who's cycling in with lots of motor traffic, vans, lorries. He's on I can't see the bike make, but you know, it's an expensive bike, I think. And he's got a courier bag over his back. So that is a classic image of cycling in London. And that's 2010, that is on there. Now this is the front cover of the latest Cycling Vision, which has just come out just last month from Transport for London. This is the embankment. There's Big Ben. And this is how they're drawing it. They still have a bit of a limited image library of cyclists, I think. One of my friends who has an adapted bike pointed out that they don't have disabled cyclists, but I think they just actually have the one image of a cyclist that they kind of put along there. But still, look at it. I mean, that's quite a different image to that. So I think
you know, the advocacy movements and the bloggers and so on, and the traditional campaign organisations have actually made a big difference in getting that as an image. Whether they will actually get it in concrete remains to be decided. But, you know, that is, that at the moment, that is basically like, you know, it's a massive highway. There's no bike infrastructure at all. There's no bus lanes, actually. It's just, yeah, cars and coaches and HGVs going up and down. It's horrid. So, I shall quote that excellent author, Aldred, again. Finally, I end the article, the latest article, just saying, well, the debates are sharp and sometimes acrimonious. So those kind of stuff around the CTC are like this. That is, you know, there's still these sharp arguments. But the movement is bigger and it's also heterogeneous. So, and the existing advocacy organisations have actually been strengthened and challenged. So their approach has been challenged. But they've also seen, certainly the London Cycling Campaign has seen membership go up and has been involved in some of these things. And the London Cycling Campaign came up with a campaign called Go Dutch, Love London, Go Dutch, which was quite a shift. Traditionally, it had been like the CTC, quite, you know, sceptical of doing these things, you know, supporting Dutch or Danish style infrastructure. So this was quite a big shift for them. This campaign was launched last year. So that was a big shift. And it was also politically successful because all five of the main mayoral candidates endorsed the Love London, Go Dutch campaign. So obviously that, you know, then will they actually, would Boris Johnson do anything about it? It's still the question to be asked. But that was, I don't think, when they initially started the campaign, the London Cycling Campaign started the Go Dutch campaign, I think they thought that, you know, the Green candidate would sign up, of course, the Labour candidate would hopefully sign up, but they didn't think the Liberal Democrat, the Conservative and the Independent candidate would sign up. So they had everybody sign up to it. And they've really got an increased level of prominence. So I think it is really an interesting story, and actually for me, as a, you know, researcher being involved in some of this, it's been really quite inspiring to see things changing, and it still may go horribly wrong, but it's been an interesting journey nonetheless. So I think that's the cost.
Questions?
It's really informing and interesting. How do the cyclists react or respond to these more movements for more common bikers?
That is interesting. It was one of the problems that Londoners on bikes sort of felt they had was that they were generally sort of left-leaning and greenish, and they would have supported the Green candidate and the Labour candidate in the mayoral elections, and their policies were better from a point of view of cycling. But because Boris Johnson, the Conservative candidate, now mayor, is a cyclist, he was seen as being the sort of the cyclist candidate to an extent. So sometimes when we were giving out flyers, people would say, oh yeah, Boris is doing a great job, I'll vote for him. And the Londoners on bike would be like, that's not what we mean. That's, you know, look at his policies, they're not that great. So there was kind of tension over how they saw ordinary cyclists and as opposed to the cycling activist community, because most people, of course, are not involved in cycling activism and haven't even signed up to one of these campaigns, and yet the movements are trying to speak for them. I think the Go Dutch campaign, the London Cycling Campaign, Go Dutch campaign, did bring in a new level of people who were, there were quite a few champions who were mothers and fathers, often with children, who wanted their children to be able to cycle with them. So they're trying to reach out to people, but you know, at the same time, there's this worry that you're preaching to the converted and you don't actually get to speak to the non-cyclist, because if you're a non-cyclist, you maybe don't get involved in that, and if you're an existing cyclist, maybe some of the existing cyclists are, you know, potentially happy with current conditions. Some of them are. There are people, there are debates on forums where people will say, well, I'm quite happy cycling in London. You know, why should I care about somebody's 12-year-old? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this cyclist and the bikey people in Lycra. If there is there a controversy between them and the Londoners on bikes, or could they be supporting each other, so to say? Do they belong to the group who are happy with the situation?
It kind of it varies, and there was some there's some debates that go on cycle forums. There are some cycle discussion forums that are very dominated by the bikey people, and one of the Londoners on bikes blokes tried to post something on the forum, and he got a lot of arguments from those people. So there were some quite sharp arguments, and some of the Londoners on bikes people also would turn up dressed in lycra and with helmets and so on. So there's certainly quite a bit of overlap, and you can't necessarily read it off. But there's still those divisions, and there's still those discussions within the organisations. And it is, as I was saying, it's a kind of tension over who are you speaking for and who are you excluding that I think is still, it's still kind of in progress. Because people, I am not a cyclist, but then to the rest of the world, you are a cyclist. So how do you manage it?
Thanks a lot for your talk. It was really, really informative and interesting. And this perspective about looking at cycle mobility from an activist perspective, do you think it's, when you say that activism, cycle activism is in London, but you don't really see it that many of your PhD students, and I'm from Copenhagen, I really don't recognize any activism there as well. Do you then think it's because of your why is advocacy such a big arena for giving a voice to neglected cyclism, cycle mobility in London, and does it sort of fit in with the political system? Does the political system actually attend to the what is said, even though it's on Twitter or on Facebook or wherever? And then also you mentioned that they drew on other narratives, the people of the London National Bikes, and mentioned the peace narrative. And then when you have this socially loop-sided representation of people biking in London, do they then also have this about the social issues, about addressing more things that would motivate people from who are not so well educated?
Yes. The thing about the other European cities, it was interesting that we had in Londoners on Bikes, I met people from Copenhagen and other places who moved to London and who would say quite interesting things about, like, I never thought of this as something political until I moved to London, and suddenly it became, oh, you're a cyclist, and it became something that I had to struggle over. And obviously, in other cities as well, it's not like everything is perfect for cycling, even when it's a lot better. So there's still a question about why is this happening in London? It's not happening in other places in the UK to that same extent. And I think it is kind of the social mix, it's kind of the way in which cycling has been increasing in these specific contexts. And you can see the guy, I was meeting with a guy from Atkins the other day who goes over to London regularly, and he said, I sat there in the rush hour and there were all these bikes going past, and I was like, yeah, it's only 2% modal share though. He's like, wow, but there's so many bikes going past, and it's just so concentrated. And it also becomes, it seemed like, from what I heard, there were some of the big employers as well who were putting some pressure on local government, saying, look, we've got 400, high-value employees parking bikes in our basement. Why are they having to deal with this rubbish? So there's kind of that side of things. And then there was the protest rise, which got another group of people interested who weren't maybe that kind of person. It's all, some of this has been slightly fortuitous as well. I mean, the way all the campaigns came together, and the way that we had a mayor who was seen as identified with cycling, even though in many respects his cycling policies were not great, it was still so the pressure then be put on him to come up with better policies, which has led to quite a big shift in what they're doing. What was the second bit of the question?
If they were drawing on in the Londoners on Bike, were drawing on other narratives and perhaps something which would address this socially.
Yes, that was one of the ways that they dealt with that, was by kind of keeping some of those other narratives out, actually, was by sort of saying, we have a lot of interest in the local environment and so on, but we don't put that in. This is about cycling, this is about cycle safety. So they kind of saw those things as being potentially attracting a more middle-class activist group, and that they felt that if they kept it more focused around cycling, it would become more politically respectable and more potentially more open to a wider range of people to be involved in. So it, I found it really interesting that in a sense they were limiting it and limiting the radicalism, but then it was still quite radical because it was pushing cycling into this space that it hadn't been before. I mean, the extent to which they were, their membership was quite heavily concentrated, particularly in two boroughs, Lambeth and Hackney, which are two inner London boroughs gentrifying high levels of cycling. And I think cycle campaigns tend to be rooted in those kind of boroughs generally, so I think they're no different from the other campaigns. What's proved hard for them is reaching out into outer London boroughs, which are, I mean, inner London, because I live in inner London and I cycle about 12 kilometres to work, so it's not that close in, but it's inner London. So then outer London is much more suburban, much like the rest of the UK, and outer London cycling levels have flatlined and inner London have gone up like that. So it's, we're almost in two cities. We've got the inner London and we've got the outer London, and in outer London the debates are, you know, really not reached the same kind of level. So it's, there was also a class element there, because traditionally inner London was the poor inner city area, but now it's more gentrified, and now outer London is becoming increasingly deprived. So there's a big issue there about equality, because potentially, you know, in inner London where I live, even though we don't have the underground, we have loads of buses. The bus network is great, and I don't, you know, don't have to worry if I need to get a bus or something like that. But in outer London, it's really different. And potentially you've got people who have a poorer cycling environment, they have lower income, they have a bad bus service, and they spend a lot of money on their car. And it's, so there is, people in the cycling movement are really aware of that, but there is the kind of question of how you reach those people and what kind of claims you make to connect with those people. And I don't think they manage, you know, it's still, I don't think any organisation is managing it really at the moment.
How has the media, because we were talking about media, and I see very much connection to Stockholm in Sweden, because Stockholm is the capital and all the big media are sitting in Stockholm. And when the Stockholm party started this bicycle infrastructure's development, the media went nuts and was totally against it. And then one little bicycle planner in Stockholm was talking to me about transport racism against cyclists, and but now they have turned, you know, that now they have noticed, okay, there are cyclists and they currently want to bike in Stockholm, so now we changed and now it's all positive. Has that appeared in London as well, or?
Yes, it has been shifting. I mean, we still have a lot of, the media tradition is really hostile to cycling in the UK, and the local press and the national press both. And when I did the cycling cultures research, I was quite shocked by how negative the local press in Cambridge was. And Cambridge is a high cycling place, but it would still be, you know, these cyclists cycling on the pavements, they're doing all these terrible things, you know, we need to get the police out and stop them doing it. So it was just totally that. And the national press, if they were interested at all, would be negative. But the Times campaign, actually, when I thought about it, it was predated by a couple of other campaigns. There was one campaign thing in 2011 by the Independent newspaper, which is a small national newspaper, sort of slightly left-leaning. And they had a bit of a Save Our Cyclists campaign, but it didn't really go very far, and they kind of fizzled out. Then the London Evening Standard, which is the London paper, kind of big right-leaning paper in London, had a cycling safety campaign, I can't remember what it's called, and that kind of ran for a bit, but it didn't get that much, it wasn't as influential. But then the Times campaign has really shifted the debate in the media, I think, and it was one of their journalists, Mary Bowers, a young journalist, was tragically very seriously injured by an HGV, near the Times offices in East London, in sort of central East London anyway. And following that, because when I spoke to some of the journalists there, basically they talked to each other about how they all cycled, it could have been them, and they really wanted to launch a campaign. So they got the editor of the Times at the time was James Harding, and was quite supportive, and they basically ran with it and had this really big campaign. And it's also pushed some other newspapers, I think, to do more about cycling as well. But the Times is really seen as the newspaper that's doing a lot about it at the moment, which is interesting because they're so establishment, and they're not the kind of newspaper you would think is doing that kind of thing. But I think the press has been less hostile to an extent. Now, the tabloids are a different matter. So we have we also have the tabloid press, which are much more... Well, we've got a range of the broadsheets are seen as being the more middle class, the Times and the So on, the middle, more middle class, sort of more upmarket papers, and the tabloids are seen as being the more down market, working class papers. And some of the tabloids still run quite luridly anti-cyclist stories as well. The Daily Mail, which is famous for being the voice of the angry petty bourgeoisie, which runs stories about, you know, cyclists ran over my cat, so that's still there. That is still there. But I think it has been moderated a bit, and it has. There's still the, I think there could be a backlash, but it has, the media coverage, I think, has improved a lot. And the fact that it's there in the Times and it's there in the Guardian, which you would expect, has made a difference. But, you know, the local press in some areas is still really bad as well. The Cambridge paper has not changed at all.
In the press, both in the sort of negative stories and the more positive now, but do they then distinguish between the different groups of cyclists that you've been talking about, like the Lycra cyclists, or, yeah?
Traditionally the image in the press was very much of the Lycra cyclist, this kind of hate figure who was self-righteous and would probably run you down at the traffic lights just because he could and because he felt like he was a cyclist and he didn't care. So that is the traditional image. And really some of it has been bordering on hate speech. I mean, Matthew Paris, who is a columnist for The Times, funnily enough, before The Times campaign, he wrote a piece saying that people should string wire across country lanes so cyclists would be garrotted. I mean, this is really hate speech, I think, and they said those kind of things as well in the broadsheets. Conjuring up this image of this evil Lycra lout who would just had disregard for the law and was dangerous. So that is still there, but it's kind of been supplanted more by an image of cyclists as being victims and as needing protection in a lot of the Times stuff now. And I think is a step forward. So you've got that, but you've still got that image of the Lycra lout as well.
And I want to, when in Sweden, when there's a newspaper article, regular people can go into the web page, and if it's online, and you can comment on that, and you can, especially in the local newspaper here in southern Sweden, you can have like, does this article make you angry, and all that. And there you can see sometimes, especially in the national newspapers, and there, focusing on Stockholm, and if something positive happening there, and if they write something about, oh yes, the Environmental Party plans this for cyclists and this is good, you can see a lot of reactions, and there you get the real hatred out of people, of regular people. But of course you don't know, because they are, it might be the same person over and over and over again, but there you can really see the hatred against cyclists. Is that something you experience in London as well? Or?
Yes, it's kind of notorious, not just for cycling though. I mean, The Guardian, for example, which is, there seem to be angry right-wing people who just spend their whole lives commenting on Guardian stories. They really do. And it's some kind of story in The Guardian about, like, cuts to refugees' benefits. There'll be a whole load of, frankly, bordering on the neo-Nazi comments from people who have nothing better to do than to do that. So we have that across a whole range of topics, but for cycling particularly. And what I started looking at, because I was doing some work around injury and how cyclists who are injured and killed were portrayed, and that was particularly horrible. When most often they won't allow comments in a case where someone's died, but sometimes they do, and when they do, the comments that you will get that will say in the Evening Standard, for example, that, well, this is what people should expect if they don't pay road tax. There are people who say that kind of thing. There are people who will apparently be happy that a cyclist has died, and it's really, so that does really, that it does exist, and it's quite alarming. I mean, you see increasingly some of the people who are the kind of people who write blogs and comment on blogs will also comment on those stories. Certainly in The Times, I think they feel maybe it's important to comment on those stories in The Times in a positive manner, because, you know, in The Times, with The Times comments, you get some kinds of slightly bewildered people, maybe retired colonels or something, who are going, I don't see why my newspaper is talking about cyclists like this. What on earth is this about? I don't want to read this kind of thing. So, but I think the kind of people who write those negative comments, they just seem to have an infinite amount of time and energy. So I think the advocates kind of sometimes struggle to, is it worth replying to these people? And I don't know how much notice the newspapers take of them? Do I mean, it would be interesting to know from journalists, yeah, how much do they look at that and say, oh, we'd better change what we're saying in response to these people, or how much do they think, yeah, this is just the internet, these things, you know, debates like this on the internet, I don't know. So I don't know how much impact it has on the editorial line. Certainly, the Times has carried on with its campaign.
I think what's very interesting, that I haven't really thought about this, but would you say that the people who write, especially these bikey people, because it's quite expensive to get that kind of bike, so it's a well-educated, well-paid, middle-class, middle-aged white men, and they that they are not used to being criticized. I would guess that some of the people who are very negative towards cyclists are in the same group, so they sort of criticizing people like themselves. And I'm thinking about the people here in Lund, because I'm an everyday cyclist, not a bikey people person, but sometimes I get dressed up in lycra and ride with these people. And they are, I mean, in the cycling club here, most people are very high educated, there are lots of doctors and lawyers and that stuff, and I guess it's the same. So do you see, will this change something? Will it, I mean, the more of these people, there should be some kind of confrontation when they go to the office and they meet these hatred people and then they come dressed in lycra, what happens?
Yeah. I don't know, I don't work in that kind of office, but yeah, no, that is really interesting, the extent to which they will have, I mean, in some cases I think it would be actually people who are quite senior, so probably some of the other people in the office are perhaps, yeah, you know, nervous about saying something. I mean, people do have, I mean, there are arguments in offices all over. I mean, some of the cycling cultures research, I didn't necessarily speak to people from that social group, but people would talk about how much you want to get into arguments at the office, how much you want to make that take over, because people will make comments, will make asides, like, oh, I nearly ran over a cyclist on my way in, you know, and if you're a cyclist, how much do you then start having an argument with that person? So there's, I think there will be that. I mean, there may also potentially be a backlash rooted in sort of resentment of people of that class as well, which will be, I don't think we're seeing that happening yet, but if cyclists are associated with the elites, and then, but I think the fact that quite a lot of people in that elite are not cyclists and are hostile to cyclists probably stops that from happening to some extent. So yeah, that is really interesting, and I would like to be flying the wall in some of those offices, but it's, to some extent it can maybe be incorporated in a kind of narrative. I mean, these people, many of these people probably own cars. They're not, so they still drive for some of their journeys. They cycle into work. It's kind of, so I guess maybe it could, you could have other people at the workplace having some tolerance for that kind of cyclist, but not other kinds. I remember one person who filled in my survey, the survey that we did on people who were involved in Londoners on Bikes, who signed up to it, and one person who was, I think, from some city firm, who said he thought it was too political, and that kind of, that level of being political about cycling was not something that he felt comfortable with. So that was maybe something to do with that, with the acceptance of cycling to a certain level could be acceptable in those contexts, but not if you made a big political issue about it. So
I just want to go shortly back to the like British policy on transport policy. How big is or has been the impact of the car industry? Because England still, or Britain has, I mean, the car industry is not big anymore, but there's still a car industry, and there has been a strong car industry. Has that had an impact on politics and policies in England?
Yeah, very much so. We do still produce a lot of cars, but the employment in the industry is lower. But it's still nationally, somehow it's symbolic, even though, yeah, it doesn't employ that many workers, and they're foreign-owned, the firms now. But it's still, there's still a thing of the British car industry. But and certainly in the post-war period, car production was very high, and car employment in the car industry is very high. And it was seen, I think, that linked to it being associated with, in that period immediately after the war, then, you know, most people would not have owned a car, but having a car was associated with, you know, being middle class, with having your own space, with having a sedentary job, and with, you know, it, it was associated with all these things that were seen as desirable at that time. And so I think the fact that we had a British car industry as well, that was seen as kind of a national, important national asset, fed into that. And politicians still give car firms lots of money to set up car plants or to stay. There was a Rover, I think it was Rover, in Coventry anyway, that recently, not that long ago, they got the local authority to build a massive road through a park to make it easier to get to their factory, and then they shut the factory a year later, but the local community still has the road and they don't have the factory anymore. So, but still these things that is kind of accepted. I think it has made a big difference, although it's obviously not a decisive thing because of the countries that also have big car industries haven't seen the annihilation of cycling in the way that we have, but it has, yeah, I think it has made a big difference. It did employ an awful lot of people in the 60s and 70s, and it was, yeah, I think it did have an impact.
Yeah, I was wondering about the connection between the two social groups of cyclists or bikers and the actual urban design solutions. Mm-hmm. So Londoners are on bikes, and also the cyclists seem to have different visions for their ideal urban design for cycling. And when we view that, should we see it as differences in actual needs of two user groups, or more like expressions of different attitudes or mm-hmm. values towards using mm-hmm. a bike? Mm-hmm. I think that would influence a lot how physical solutions could be made mm-hmm. in the city.
Yeah,
I'm very interested in that.
Yeah. No, I think that is a really interesting point. I think it's probably, both. Particularly when you're talking about a wider range of solutions. Traditionally, there has been a tendency on behalf of the CTC type organisations to portray, cycling on the road with lots of motor traffic as being perfectly fine if you know what you're doing, which I think is a bit of an expression of this is cycling for the fit and the super competent. So that I think was kind of linked to a particular group that can cope with a particular type of conditions. But then there's some really interesting debates now around, shared space, segregated paths, different kinds of environments. What are you trying to create? What should cycling be like? Is cycling a kind of slow mode like walking, or is it something that's traffic? Does it have its own space? So I think those things are maybe often to do with the attitudes and the imaginary of the city and so on. But the idea that you should be happy cycling along with lots of lorries overtaking you, I think is probably representative of a small group that likes that kind of thing. There are people who like that kind of thing, but it's not most people, I think.
Actually, I thought the idea of wanting to bike among cars looks like a pretty macho value.
Yeah, there's a lot of people have made that point in the kind of bike blogging and some of the literature that this is a kind of mindset where you're skilled, you're doing something a bit dangerous, and that's why they say young men particularly have been taking it up, because it's seen as a kind of risky pursuit that's a bit exciting, a bit on the edge, and so on. But what's interesting as well is some of the people that I've spoken to, they were those people, and now they're a bit older, now they've got kids, now they don't really like doing it anymore. They can't get up to 25 miles an hour the way they used to, and they'd like to be cycling with a kid on the back, but they don't feel they can. So they've sort of developed more of a connection towards some what they might have seen as the slower cyclists, and they kind of they have a slightly different view now. And there's also people who enjoy cycling in traffic but kind of feel politically that it's exclusive, that it shouldn't, people shouldn't have to do this even though they themselves are happy. And then there's other people who feel very strongly that people should learn to ride in traffic, and sometimes you wonder what people are actually seeing. Your attitude shapes so much how you experience it. So one person who we interviewed for the Cycling Cultures Project, I didn't interview myself, but who is very, very anti-segregation, and who described, he'd gone to the Netherlands, and he said his route from London to Harwich was wonderful. It was great in England. He could cycle where he wanted. It was fantastic. He had a great choice of routes. And then he got off at Hook of Holland, and it was a nightmare, and he had to cycle along this pothole little path, and the police nearly arrested him when he tried to cycle on the road, and it was just terrible, and he wanted to be back in England. And you kind of thought, obviously you have your preferences, but how can you actually, how can that, yeah, do people do? It's shaped by that.
From a traffic or sitting here at the transport engineering department, you learn a bit about traffic safety. And we have had this separation, and which has gone, it depends how it is sorted out. And in Holland it is great, but the way it has been done, especially in the 60s and 70s in Sweden, has not been really great, because that left the car traffic untouched. It was the free flow and tunnels under it, and then cycling tracks were not connected to the rest of the city and all that. But I think you can mix traffic if you have the right street design and the right speed limits, and make sure that the speed limits are low, and it depends a bit how you solve it, because also in Holland there are streets, and when it is mixed, then they say, okay, now the cars can go here mixed with cyclists, but then we have a speed limit on I don't know, 25, 30 kilometers per hour, and we look after that it is that cars go 50, 60, 70, and then you can mix it from a traffic safety point of view, and I think people would feel much safer. But of course, if you have like a road with, I don't know, four lanes, lorries, trucks, SUVs going 60, 70 kilometers per hour, then of course it's very horrible. I mean, this is, but it's not all bad if you mix traffic, or bicycle traffic and motorized traffic.
I guess the two things, I mean, I suppose the traffic safety point of view is not the only one that maybe people also want.
No.
But there's other values that they want as well as the safety, but also the Dutch, for example, if a main road, if it's a main cycle route, they would not have more than 2,000 motor vehicles per day using that. They don't believe in mixing lots. There's also a volume limit, which I think is really important, because it means like you're not getting traffic going past you constantly at 20 miles an hour. You go, but in London, the context for us in London is that we have such high levels of motor traffic and this has been done. We've had road traffic. We've got a lot of 20 mile an hour limits. So we do have a lot of mixing at 20 miles an hour, but it's still really problematic, because you often have backed up queues of traffic. As a cyclist, you just can't get past them. And so if they cut the motor traffic to 2,000 motor vehicles a day, that'd be great. But they don't do that. They just slow speeds, which is good, but it's not going to make a nice cycling environment. So what I would like to see personally would be, okay, this is the maximum number of motor vehicles we should have, and it's okay. You know, if you're sharing with a small number of motor vehicles, fine, at low speeds, or if you're on a segregated path, that's fine too, but you shouldn't be expected to share with high volumes or high speeds. So I would say, as long as there's a low limit, which is pretty low, then I wouldn't, personally, I wouldn't mind which it was, although I think that people would probably prefer their children to be totally away from motor vehicles, or some people would, so there's different preferences as well, I guess.
Anna?
In the Copenhagen cycle policy, they distinguish between the safety of the cycle infrastructure and the sense of safety that the cyclists have. And do the people you interviewed make this distinction, or is it just...
Yes, I think that's really important, and I think often when people talk about feeling unsafe, they're not necessarily talking about a specific risk of being hit. They're often talking about the feeling of comfort, the feeling of pleasant experience on their journey. So potentially, and one of the things the new advocates talk about is, okay, you know, it may be safe, but if it doesn't feel safe, that's not good enough. Because in London, we often share with buses. We have cycles in bus lanes, and for me, I actually personally find that okay, because bus drivers in London are relatively good. They're much better than they are in the rest of the country, and I find it relatively okay, but many people don't. Many people hate it, which is understandable, and they will say, you know, it doesn't feel good to have this massive vehicle behind me and overtaking me and have to overtake it. And, you know, you can say to that person, and I've heard more traditional cycling advocates sort of say to that person, it's not dangerous, it just feels dangerous. And I feel, well, you're just onto a loser when you're saying that. I mean, you know, if it feels dangerous, it's not good enough, is it? I mean, and this is going to be an issue for us in London, to be honest, because we've had bus priority, which in many ways has been a good thing, but it means that there are a lot of bus... there are a lot of bus lanes, there's a lot of bus infrastructure, and potentially is it okay for cyclists to share with that? And, you know, my feeling is that, you know, ultimately cyclists shouldn't be expected to share with buses, and certainly the Dutch think we're completely mad. But we've kind of got used to it. So those of us who currently cycle have got used to it.
Do you think there's a lack of acceptance of trying to how you say, work with cars and limit the use of cars is the congestion charge and the bus lanes. Mm-hmm. And so in the public debate that there also seems to be like things can be changed. Mm-hmm. Because it seems to me that that's been kind of the involvement of the debate mm-hmm. in a way. So.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's still a big issue. It's like everywhere you still have the problem of the car, don't you? It's not, you know, nowhere has solved that. And it keeps encroaching if we don't stop it. But in London, that is, it's a lot less acceptable to drive than it is in the rest of the UK. In London, car ownership is falling. Now in my borough of Hackney and in Westminster, the borough of Westminster where I work, both those places, quite different, 2/3 of households don't have a car in both those places, which is, so not, you know, people who don't own a car in inner London are in a majority, households without a car, in fact. So there is, the discourse has shifted. And another thing that's really indicative is that outside London in the UK, you can park on the pavement, it's okay. And that really annoys me. Every time I go outside London, there's always cars on the pavement, even though there's loads of room on the road. But in London, you can only park on the pavement if you're specifically allowed. So again, that's something that restricts the car. The congestion charge has had a really big impact, I think, in terms of legitimising driving. And now that people have to pay a charge to go into central London, I mean, there were some problems with it, but in that respect, I think it's been good. And also the money went into buses, so that kind of legitimised, okay, we're taking money from car drivers, we're putting it into bus provision. And then there was an increase in bus use. So I think in London, certainly, there is some acceptance that you can curb the car, even though it's really strongly contested. And we had falling, most traffic fell by 20%, although congestion didn't fall. But partly because pedestrian priority schemes, partly because of bus priority schemes, and partly because of just loads of work going on. So during the Olympics, driving fell dramatically during the Olympics. Suddenly you could take away all these lanes, and unfortunately give them to VIPs rather than to pedestrians, cyclists and so on, but you could take away all these lanes. And chaos didn't happen, you know, things actually worked okay. So that's a big argument at the moment within Transport for London and those kind of circles, you know, can we actually talk about traffic evaporation and then do something based on that? Yeah. Okay. I think that's 12 o'clock. So thank you very much. That was a really interesting discussion.